Well, welcome to the Service Course podcast. This is episode number 2. If you missed episode 1, you can go back and check it out and hear a little bit about who we are and where we've been. Just wanted to remind or let our listeners know what a service course is and why the name. We were all coached by a gentleman with the name of Doug Knox from Santa Barbara, who was a legendary coach and developer of a lot of rider talent. He had a repair shop, a customization shop called Service Course. I think that's probably one of the first places I heard the name. But, you know, the time trial bikes from the tour are loaded on a semi-truck and probably on their way back to Belgium or Girona, Spain, to the Service Course. So each professional team has a warehouse where the mechanics are building the bikes, where all the nutrition is stored, where all the, you know, it's kind of like the corporate headquarters. So that's where the name Service Course comes from. So I'm joined today by Kurt and Darren Stockton. My name's Ed Philbrick, and today we're going to focus a little bit about the Tour de France, some local ride stories from the 4th of July weekend, what kind of rides we both did or we all did. We'll touch on Greg LeMond, things that we see going on out and about in our travels in the cycling world. So let's just kick it off. One of the first things that we've been seeing a lot of is the conversation about the Tour. What have you guys noticed?
The Tour.
Yeah.
A couple of things I noticed is that it seems like nobody wears jerseys and bibs anymore. It's like it's like all skin suits. And remember when you were a kid, you had like one skin suit that you wore in time trials and maybe you wore it in a criterium. And I was like, now everybody wears a one piece. And I was like, that's like thinking, wow, this is kind of this crazy evolution, but everyone's trying to get every little bit and piece of advantage they can. Although I guess if everyone is aero, then there kind of is no advantage. But then you think back to the 1980 Tour de France and little-known Canadian, Alex Steeda. I think it was in the second stage or stage 2A. He lined up to the start of that stage, and guess what? He was wearing a skin suit. Got off in the breakaway, got enough time bonuses that he actually took the yellow jersey, I think along with the green jersey and the polka dot jersey and the combined jersey. I think he had every single jersey.
Yeah.
But that was what's old is new. Like, skin suits in road racing are not new, and in the Tour de France are not new. And I think you could say the pioneer in the Tour de France was Alex Steeda. So, you know, hats off to you, Link. It was cool that they finally caught up with you. It only took about almost 40 years.
And I remember him getting panned, and our friend Shelley Versus, who was the soigneur for the Tour team, they were talking about how as Steeda rolled up to the start line in the skin suits, the established Euro pros were kind of scoffing at him. But then obviously a couple hours later, he was putting all the jerseys on. So, yeah, pretty cool story on that.
Yeah. And I mean, and that, any other trends or quirks? I somehow got Victor Campernart's Instagram feed into my feed. So a little bit when I look at social media, if you haven't checked it out, he's great. He's been interviewing his teammates before each stage and asking them personal questions, you know, and it's fun.
He's a character.
He's a character, and it takes away that sometimes robotic feel, you know, us as spectators can get with these World Tour riders when there's so much at stake. And it's just fun to see that the human side, and, you know, as difficult as it is for all these athletes, having a laugh and then sharing it with us is pretty cool. So yeah, those are trends, gears, quirks. It's just cool stuff.
Yeah. Today, Victor Campenaerts had Sepp Kuss on. And Sepp hasn't been riding that great, you know, or well, we haven't got to the high mountains. He'd probably be fine by the time we get there. But he had like, he's like, oh, you got to put on the nose strip. And if you put it on properly, you could sleep with it. And you could probably keep that same nose strip on for 24 hours. So it was, you know, kind of a clever little take.
Yeah.
Now, actually, I'm kind of curious. Is anybody selling advertising on the nose strip?
No? Shouldn't have said that.
I mean, come on.
You've got to capitalize on that.
I can't believe they're putting sponsors' names everywhere. You'd think on the nose strip you would be bringing something up. Nose strip sponsorship. Yeah.
So what do you think about Primoz Roglic? Has he been consequential? Has he played a role in the tour? Are you disappointed? Are you surprised? What do you think?
I thought we would have seen more of him in these Ardennes Classic-styled stages. He's been so prolific in those types of courses throughout his career. I thought we would have seen a little bit more of that. But again, maybe he shifted his focus. I heard a little something that, you know, that's what the team management is saying, that, you know, you back off that a little bit to be better in the high mountains. We'll see. But now that he's a couple minutes down between that and the time trials, you know, I just thought we would have seen more of his explosive racing style.
Yeah.
What do you think, DS?
I would have to say I'm not too surprised, only because it seemed like his Giro, you know, he crashed out. And while I do agree you would think he would be a little bit better on the punchy finishes, I think it kind of just depends on how he came out of the Giro and did he have enough time to, you know, he rode pretty deep into the Giro before he quit. It's not like it was, you know, 1 week. So he was probably tired and you got to back out of it, recover from whatever your injuries are, and then turn around and come back. Yeah. So, you know, I can't say I'm surprised that he hasn't been up there at the front.
I wonder how his psychology is doing when he's thinking about, and he's obviously hearing that Remco is probably coming to the team, and, you know, that would probably be the winding down of the Roglic era.
Right.
Today's rumor was that Remco is, you know, 70-80% of the way signed with Red Bull, that he's not talking to Ineos anymore, and that the Lidl Trek deal is just not going to happen, that most likely Specialized will swing their weight and he'll arrive at Red Bull.
Go ahead, Kurt.
I say it makes sense, and he was, you know, rumored to that team very early on. Maned, you bring up a great point about Specialized. Like, they, if you followed how they've liked to stay with athletes, right? And then they stay with teams, but really with athletes. You look at Demi Vollering moving from SD Works to Frances de Joux, Specialized came along with that. So I don't think that's surprising. And ultimately, you know, you look at the lineup that Quickstep brought to the tour, it's not 100% for Remco. They did get a stage win with Tim Miller a couple days ago, so they got that. But when, you know, it's got to be a little disheartening when you've won a Grand Tour already and, you know, you've won stages in the Tour de France, in your debut, you finished on the podium, and the team does not support you 100%. So,
yeah.
That was my take. Yeah.
Those are all the points.
Yeah.
So Vindigo, obviously, you know, Jonas obviously struggled in the time trial. I think people have been a little unfair with him. And, you know, maybe this is a little bit of a rope-a-dope moment where Pogačar was maybe better for the time trial, or he went back to the wind tunnel, or he went back to elevation to bring out the performance, or it was the headwind. What did you guys think of the TT?
I thought it was an interesting time trial for sure. You know, Remco's position, I mean, is pretty incredible. And obviously there was a bit of tactics out there as guys were going out hard and then dying a bit on the end. He seemed like he really timed that right, really made up his energy at the end. But I agree, Vingo just didn't look quite like he, you know, had it. But maybe it's just because the stage wasn't quite for him. I think everybody, they're looking now like, oh, is that a surprise ride for Todd? I even heard some of the commentators saying, oh, it's the ride of his life. Although that may have just been Phil Liggett. But but it seems like the Dauphiné is probably the only bad time trial that guy's had in how long. And I really think his Dauphiné time trial, if you watched his interview at the start of the Dauphiné and they asked him how everything was going, he's like, oh, no, it's been pretty good. Train's been good. He goes, I wish I would have had a little bit more time at home before getting back out to the races. And I think it was maybe just a bit of a mentality effort. I mean, I'm sure obviously the form is building and there's those parts of it. I think part of it was just he in a way just looked like he was just like, okay, let me just get through this, you know? And I think that was where some of his performance came. And so when people are comparing that time trial to the tour, I think maybe their expectations were low of how good Pogačar is going to do. But I mean, he's obviously a great time trialist.
Yeah. And you look at the total, like, what do we have? Just 44 Ks total over two time trials in this year's tour. So that obviously the amount of time that can be gained or lost in a mountain stage in proportion to the individual time trials is a lot greater for the 2025 edition.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, you don't ever want to give up any time to your rivals, but, you know, if you need to really focus on your strengths, maybe you've got a guy like Vingegaard or even Roglic, you know, focusing more on their preparation toward the higher mountains and then just trying not to lose so much in the time trial. And then,
yeah,
like you said, DS, maybe Pogačar had an off day at the Dauphiné, and that's better than having an off day at the Tour that maybe Vingegaard had. And yeah, all you can do is go forward to the next stage, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and the Dauphiné is not the Tour de France, so there's a big difference.
Yes.
The other thing is the second time trial, just to remind everybody, is uphill. It does have 4K of flat. So that's why the time trial bikes are on their way back to the service course, because they're probably not going to ride them or do the bike change scenario.
Right. Climbing bikes, maybe with a clip-on system or something for those 4K of flats to make you a little bit more aero.
Yeah.
Well, it is one thing I'd say about time trials too, is it's, I know that it's something that the tour directors have changed in recent years, but I mean, it's amazing when you used to think, right? They've got 44 total K of time trialing, I think you just said. You used to think the long time trials in the tours were like 50K or something, right? 30-mile time trials and stuff like that. I mean, in like the Le Mans and Inderon and even up through into the Lance era. But I think they got to the point where if the time trials were too long and somebody had a minute and a half gap after that, then it was just kind of a boring watching one team, you know, set tempo at the front all week.
Yeah.
So they've shortened them down.
Shorting, and it does. It keeps the racing, right? If we can keep the gaps smaller and more people can be in contention to shake up the GC. You know, it tends to focus on who's going to win, or it's focusing on these two guys. But a top 10 at the Tour de France could be career changing for so many of these riders. So maybe we touch on later in the tour is how well the French are riding. A couple of young French riders with Kevin Vauquelin and then Romain Grégoire. So that's pretty cool to see as well.
Yeah, Vauquelin did an amazing time trial.
Yeah,
and he's basically on a team that's going to go away next year.
Right. Yeah.
Well, he's riding for his future.
Yeah. I was pondering today, you know, everyone's always trying to preserve their podium place in the tour. And so if Jonas, you know, he's finished second, this will be, he's finished second twice so far. So yeah. I don't think he wants to finish second again. I would like to see him go bombs away and just go for it and not try and preserve his podium place. But then I had a thought. I go, if he goes bombs away and it backfires, it could put Remco in second on the podium. I'm not sure Remco is going to be great in the high mountains. I'm just saying, like, it would be nice to see. I don't like podium preservation. I want to see him race.
Right. Race for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Make it good for the fans.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of fans, something else that has caught me off guard a little bit is watching the women's racing on the women's side. And there were a couple of big transfers over the off season with two top riders in Demi Vollering and Marlene Reusser leaving the SD Works team, which has been so dominant the last several seasons. It was like they were racing for first and everyone else was racing to pick up what was left. And oftentimes you'll see riders, you know, they leave a program and they go somewhere else and they're not as successful. And it's been great to see this kind of the power being spread out, the results being spread out with the Frances de Jeu team with Vollering and Marlene Reusser going to Movistar. You know, she won her home tour in the Tour de Suisse, took the lead at the women's Giro Rosa and lost it and then just got it back. I think it was today or yesterday. So she's racing really well. I mean, granted, we don't have all the players there because they're all really going to line up for the Tour de France Femme in a few weeks, but it's just been really fun to see that it's actually
parity.
Parity in the racing, you know?
Yeah.
And giving those riders a chance and, you know, them being hungry and going for it. So that's been very cool to watch. So the women's Giro does run through this weekend. So if you haven't caught any of that, or you can even catch some highlights, that's kind of that's the last big warm-up race here before the women's tour.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is.
Are you watching that on Max, or how are you consuming that?
Most of my consumption is highlights via YouTube channels. There is a Giro YouTube channel just because I don't have the time to sit there and watch it all. Nor do I want to give that much money to so many different subscription services.
So for our next segment, we were going to talk about the 4th of July rides that were taking place and the rides that we all did the last weekend. I did two rides on the 4th. I did the Lences More ride put on by Courier, which is a North County club created by Michael Marks, the promoter of the Belgian Waffle ride.
So Ed, North County, for people that don't know what that is, you are in North County.
North County, San Diego.
Yeah, so the Lences More ride, we covered this last week, but unfortunately Kevin Lentz was hit and killed by an intoxicated, drug-impaired driver who was on the wrong side of the road, and he was on a technical descent out in Escondido. So we rode to the location where that took place, and there's a ghost bike there, and the city of Escondido has actually put up a nice road sign for him as well.
Oh, that's cool.
So it was a great ride, and Courier does an amazing thing. We call it All Stripes, where we bring all the clubs together. So all the clubs ride together, and I think it's a kind of a really cool thing that goes on in North County is that, you know, all the clubs will show up for one ride and ride together. Because, you know, clubs are a little clicky and clubs come and go. And it's just kind of nice to have the All Stripes ride where all the clubs show up and ride together.
That is great. Because at the end of the day, you're all out there riding bikes, which is what's most important, regardless of which club jersey that you have on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it's not just all about what better discounts you get from your club, right? Had to throw that in. I mean, come on, at the end of the day, you know, we're all recreational cyclists trying just to have a good time. Don't forget that.
So speaking of discounts and jerseys, the Sunday ride was, it kind of snuck by and I didn't quite grab the promotion for it, but it was put on by ASOS and it was hosted by Cadence in Encinitas. Now, ASOS is, you know, a Swiss apparel company, high-end apparel company. I think we all wore ASOS shorts at one time.
Yeah.
It was an amazing event. It was nice to see money being spent on a little local ride, you know. They had a particular jersey that they were launching. They had Taylor Finney there and Safa, who's Mr. Downhill, YouTuber. And also an incredible road cyclist. He was at the front. And at the front of that ride, we had Taylor Finney, Chris Powell, who was a dual slalom rider, who's an incredible road cyclist in his 40s. Victor Sheldon, Luke Pankowitz. We had, it was quite the ride. And there was a photo car out in front, kind of kept it safe. They had plenty of food. They had a DJ. It was really well done. And there was a lot of really good photography that came out of that event and good marketing for ASOS. Just a well done event. How about you, KS?
Well, over the 4th of July weekend, I did something that I've never done before. I don't know if I mentioned that I was going to do this last week, but I traveled to a pickleball tournament. Now, I'm not playing pickleball. I'm just trying not to be a pickleball widower every time Robin plays. But Robin was in a pickleball tournament on the 5th up in South Lake Tahoe. And so with that, we're about 45, 50 minutes from Truckee. Part of the way up Interstate 80 to Donner Pass, I jumped out of the car, jumped on my road bike, and rode up over Donner Pass, down into Truckee, and then over to Tahoe City on my road bike. It's about 35 miles. As terrible as the traffic can be on the 4th, most of it is focused around the lakes, Donner Lake, and then especially Lake Tahoe. I got around Donner Lake. It still wasn't too bad. And by the time I got to Lake Tahoe, I got back in the car. So that was awesome. Probably the best part of the ride was of the 35 miles. I think I had a headwind for 34 and three quarters miles. So I did not have a headwind. I had a tailwind. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Had I had a headwind, I wouldn't even made it up to the top of that. So I had tailwind all the way up. I think it was just coming down off of Donner Pass. It was a bit gusty, which, I had these 38 millimeter, deep wheels, which isn't too deep by today's standards. We'll talk about wheels later. And that was a little sketchy with those gusts. It was pretty windy that day. And then spectated the next day, watched some pickleball, didn't ride my bike because I was a little bit tired. And then got out on a great gravel ride with my best riding buddy, Chris Foyt, on Sunday, right out here in Nevada City. Best kept secret in gravel in Northern California or anywhere. You just got to be prepared to either go up or downhill. So that was a great two rides in 3 days.
Nice.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Well,
my
weekend ride, I actually only rode on the 4th. The next 2 days, I was out doing stuff with my daughter both days. But my 4th of July ride, I live here in Carpinteria, California, which is just south of Santa Barbara. And we have a great local trail, the Franklin Trail, which actually goes all the way up to the very top of the mountains, Camino Cielo. Actually, at that point, it's a Divide Peak. It's an old OHV dirt road. But I went out and did an e-bike ride with two buddies. And you kind of ride up fire roads and stuff, mostly a little bit of technical. And then when you get to the top, this original 1913 trail, it's called, which is because the original trail was built in 1913. And this is one of the existing parts of the single track. So you can kind of ride up the fire road and then drop down the single track. And we ride up and do three loops. But the cool thing is with e-bikes, which I just think is one of the main benefits of it, and I experience with other people that I ride with, is there were three of us, all of pretty varying abilities, but we were all able to ride together on the way up in BS, just like, say, the three of us would have done back when we were riding, because we're all of similar fitness. But nowadays, you know, you have people you can ride of different abilities, and it's great that you can all just tune the power a little bit differently and ride up together. So you get that part of the ride together, and then we dropped down and did three loops on that and then came back down. So that was my 4th of July ride.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
For the next segment, we thought we would cover, you know, some of the big marquee moments that we've had in the tour, and specifically the crashes. So I think we'll take a quick look at the Philipson crash. We'll do a little screen share here.
Yeah, and hope we don't get taken down by the ASO or YouTube. Well, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, due to their stringent copyright tactics. Yeah, it's definitely the tour. There's always crashes in the first week of the tour, as anybody who's watched the tour before. Here we go.
Ryder is trying to lead him out. Gamay's a bit... Oh! Philipson crashes! Oh. The green jersey is down. Jonathan Milan goes through now. He wins the sprint. But behind...
That was rough.
We hope that Jasper Philipson is okay.
Well,
oh, that's not good.
And I think we don't need to keep watching that over and over, because it was pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest thing is just how dangerous it could be and how quickly your race can change in just the blink of an eye. You know, we watched this, we were talking about it before we went live. And I think something that nobody's talking about in this crash, well, a couple of things, but the first being that had Kokar not been in clipless pedals, I mean, everyone rides clipless pedals these days, but back in the toe clip and strap days, they would have had contact like that and his feet wouldn't have popped out. That crash would have been much worse than it was. You know, the fact that only Philipson went down versus a bunch of those guys going down was pretty incredible. You have clipless pedals to thank for that 100%. And then DS, you brought up a point too, just about the contact and how it took place and right. Like, why Jasper wasn't sliding on his butt, why he went in shoulder first.
Yeah, if you look at the way that played out, because people are asking, you know, was it bad racing? Was it just a racing incident? I mean, it was really a racing incident. Obviously, when you're in a fast and furious sprint like that, there's a lot of room for people to make moves. I think if you could just see that Kokard didn't really realize that Kermea's lead out guy was coming up around the right, because he was, you know, kind of moving up on him. And he went to dive right and they contacted. But when Kokard comes back, if people go back and watch it, he actually contacts Philipson's handlebar. And that's why Philipson's crash, I think, was so bad. Is, you know, if you would come back and cross somebody's wheel, even if your front wheel gets taken out, there's maybe a moment where you're leaning or, you know, you kind of slide in. But in this, when you get your handlebar taken out, I mean, Philipson's front wheel just goes out from under him and he's on his, you know, shoulder and head so fast that he doesn't even, you know, have a chance. And so that was really why that crash was so violent. And I mean, just a bummer, right? And that's the ups and downs of professional racing. I mean, think about Philipson. He obviously is looking like he's the fastest guy in the race, and his fortunes go from winning a stage, having the yellow jersey, being in the green jersey, and then he's in a hospital bed giving thumbs up from his social media posts. So the cruelties of pro racing at that level.
And how quickly his fortunes changed explains why riders are all sprinting for those points. So we go back a few years, I believe it was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago when Michael Matthews won the green jersey, Marcel Kittel.
Yeah.
I was running away with that thing and he crashed out. And guess who won the green jersey? Guy who
That's
had been
right.
consistent up to that point. So for all those people who say, oh, you shouldn't be there. I mean, I believe it was one of the Alpecin riders said that. It's like every rider has the right to be everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And that's understandable, those guys in the heat of the moment saying that stuff. But everyone has their own goals. Each team has its own goals and requirements. And, you know, unfortunately, it's part of racing.
Yep, that's it. I will have to say, though, if you did have to get crashed out on stage 3, you couldn't have had too much better of a tour than Philipson had. I mean, wins the first day, gets the yellow jersey, gets the green jersey, right? And then he's out. So at least, you know, at least he can throw that in his palmarès. So.
And when he gets green, his teammate goes into yellow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But there's another crash that caught our attention, I think, a bit more, huh, Ed?
Yeah. Let's pull up this KOM sprint here.
Yeah.
Omar checks over the shoulder again. First day check, 24 seconds now. This peloton is coming quick.
So they got pressure from the back right now as well.
Yeah.
Benjamin Thomas.
Spicy sprint.
Side of the road, and they're on cobble, so they can't get out the saddle. Look at the wheels bouncing all over the place. Berger goes, Thomas goes on the left hand side. Photo finish. Finish of the breakaway. Both riders in the breakaway are down. I have never seen that ever.
I think it's good to watch the slow-mo that's
let
about
alone
to come
in the Tour de France, in any bike race I've ever commentated on.
Yeah,
look at this for a sprint.
Here we go.
Look how far apart they are.
The place.
Yeah,
Thomas
watch
throws
this
the
front
bike
wheel.
And then throws the race away.
Oh. I mean,
what a crash.
Dude, the arms go in the hand when he's still sliding.
Berger
the arms go in the air just about.
What's
come
just
on.
Happened.
Yeah. Another unfortunate one, but I think that was racing. I mean, and you look at those guys, like there was enough room in between them for another rider to be there.
Right.
Like, they weren't right next to each other. But I mentioned getting caught by those gusts descending off of Donner Pass the other day on the 4th and getting blown around with a 38mm front wheel rim profile on my bike. You know, talking about the crash here and this and that, but it's like this goes back to our discussion we had in episode 1. You know, the UCI trying to make racing safer, right? Speed and this and that. It's like, is there anything for either of these two crashes that any of these, quote, regulations that have been put in or going to be put in would have changed in any of either of those instances?
Yeah, not that I see. No. Yeah. And the cobblestone crash, what I find is really interesting about that is you were bringing up, Kurt, that ties into our episode 1, and we were discussing, you know, the rules changes and safety and how, you know, they're making changes or trying to make changes to bike design strictly for aerodynamics to bring the speed down. But this wasn't speed based. But if you can see how much those guys are bouncing around as they go up the cobbles, that has a lot to do with bikes that have a more aero profile are just less compliant radially, which would mean up and down, you know, not laterally side to side, and especially the deep wheels. And you can see as they're sprinting up that, their bikes are bouncing all over and the bike throw and his rear wheel comes out and then his front wheel slides and catches a cobble and he's ejected. And you really have to wonder if they were on a standard, you know, more traditional tubed road bike with a set of 36, you know, millimeter wheels, would that same bouncing around and crash have happened? Possibly, possibly not, but definitely it's something that I think goes to what they're talking about for the UCI of trying to make races safer. You know, is it just the speed? Like we said, it doesn't seem like either of these two crashes, aerodynamics were involved.
And it's like trying to have this balance between innovation and safety, because the bike companies are going to keep pushing, right? They want to innovate. I mean, we're still riding bikes with, you know, double triangles and two wheels and a chain and chain rings and gears, right? So how do they innovate? I mean, the bike itself has not changed much. Materials have changed, profiles have changed, but the bicycle as itself hasn't changed much in the last 100 years, really, from its basic design. So you're always going to have, you know, engineers, designers, product people wanting to push the envelope to come up with the next best thing. I don't know what the next best thing is.
Well, Aero had a pretty good day today with Ben Healy soloing for 42K by himself. You know, he's Mr. Aero. He rides a smaller frame. You'll notice he had enough padding on his bars that he could basically ride the tops almost as Aero bars. And I also found it noticeable today. I saw his cadence was 98 RPM average for the entire stage.
That's impressive.
Yeah. His average heart rate was 154. I'm like, oh, that sounds reasonable. But the cadence, I'm like, I still can't quite fathom 98 average cadence for the entire stage.
That's impressive. But, you know, the science says the more watts you're putting out, the higher RPM is better, you know, better on your joints, better on your muscles. It will allow you to recover and put that power out. Yeah.
My internet was glitching on your whole explanation there, so I missed that. I have no comment.
This will happen with technology.
Yes. Yeah. Technology.
Yeah. All right.
So with that, yeah, and I mean, I think time will tell on that. On DS, you mentioned this last week, like everyone's talking about how this setup is faster or it's lighter or it, you know, does this for you or that for you. No one's talking about compliance and bike handling.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if does that discussion ever come up or not. Bike handling is the individual riders. Compliance is what's designed into the equipment. You know, and as we get so much carbon fiber, I don't know how many of these teams, some of them are 3D printing right there, handlebars for time trial and stuff. But ultimately, right, if a wheel comes out of the Shimano factory, you know, does you know, Matthew Vanderpool ride the same Durace wheel as Romain Grégoire? Those are two completely different riders on Shimano-sponsored teams, you know, and if the wheels are just coming out of a wheel factory, I mean, that's the one thing, it's like that you can still tune on a bike if you have someone building your wheels is tune a wheel for you.
Yeah, different spokes, different lacing, different tension.
Different tensions, yeah. There's all of that stuff. So it'll be interesting to see if the conversation comes up. Maybe we just keep pushing it.
If
any of our listeners out there have thoughts on that, on bicycle compliance. And no, it's not like we all need to go back on steel bikes and 32 hole three cross wheels. Like let's be constructive with it. So
that ship has sailed.
We appreciate it. Yes, it has. Yes, it has.
But I'll tell you what, those, you know, I found something interesting for my product designing is, you know, I really realized how it's great having a bike of an era. Like I've saved a lot of my older bicycles. And there was a certain point when I was like, oh, you know, I was riding one bike and the parts are getting a little outdated. And I started switching some parts out and, you know, trying to update a little bit. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to take those bikes back and put them back the way they were in the era that I rode them. And for me as a designer, it's really great because I could look at a bike and say, oh, it weighs this much. Here's the head angle. Here's the fork rake. Here's all of this. But just going out and riding one of those bikes, you feel so much of how different it is than what we ride today, you know, and definitely the bikes of today are so much better. I mean, I'm not advocating going back necessarily. I love disc brakes, you know, I love fatter tires. I love all of that stuff. But at the same time, I could go hop on my original time carbon bike that I got in, I think, 2003 and go out and ride that thing, be like, oh yeah, there's a couple things that this does really nicely. It's very stable. It doesn't transmit a lot of road shock. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting to go back and ride bikes of the era as they were just to give you a feel and a flavor for how far things have come.
Okay,
very cool.
I think covered that segment. The next segment we wanted to touch on a little bit is that Greg LeMond was honored with the Congressional Gold Medal last week. And I think Greg is, you know, interwoven into a lot of our lives in different ways. I remember talking with him at the first Giro trade show booth, the first time Giro had a foam helmet. And, you know, we had good little chats and Greg was super friendly and always fun to race against. I don't know. I think DS, you probably raced against him without a helmet, you know, at Fashion Island in Newport Beach.
Yes. I even have a few photos you took to prove that I actually raced without a helmet at some point.
Yeah.
The back when wanting to be a pro got the better of our common sense, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So cool, dude. Your hair's like blowing in the wind. Put a headband on. I used to love that. I can't believe we used to do sprint training and like climb up the mountains and come down Gibraltar at full speed on a bike with no helmet. Like if I even go out, like the other day, I actually was getting ready to go out for a gravel ride and riding up to meet my buddy. And I was trying to get all the stuff out of my van and getting squared away. And I roll out the door and, you know, I hadn't put my gloves on yet. So I'm kind of like sitting up and I'm sticking my gloves on. I'm going, God, something feels weird. And I realized it was the wind blowing through my hair and I had left my helmet hanging in. I have a hook in my van. So turned around and went back and did it. But I wouldn't even consider going out and riding without a helmet now. No way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Greg played an important role in U.S. cycling, but he got a little bit eclipsed by Armstrong. So it's nice to see him recognized and honored and his contribution to the sport and to the bike
industry.
The bike industry and sunglasses and helmets and all that we wear. And you know, early sports marketing. He was in a Taco Bell commercial. So
yeah,
he plays an important role. KS, I know you rode with him at the Worlds in 1990. What was that like?
Take it off a mute there. Trying to keep the sound down. Yeah, riding in support of Greg LeMond at the 1990 Worlds in Japan in Utsunomiya was almost surreal. You know? And it was especially cool because he had won the year before. So the year before was his comeback year after being shot,
yeah.
If you remember. And he came back and he historically won the Tour de France on the final day in a time trial where he beat, you know, the Frenchman in yellow. I mean, that was the last time there was a French guy in yellow that was going to win, right? It's been since 85, since he now won the tour. But yeah, he beat Fignon in that final time trial by 8 seconds and then went on and won the Worlds later that year. And he was on a small ADR team out of Belgium. I think he only had two or three teammates that actually finished the tour that year. Then he went on and won the Worlds. So the next year, right, he had signed that big contract in the offseason with the Zed team. Our first million-dollar cyclist, as they said back then, although it was over multiple years. So he was a defending champion. So it was a big group, a bunch of young guys that went and rode. I mean, I think really, if I recall correctly, the only European-based rider on the U.S. team that race was Andy Hampston. Mm. And other than Andy, it was just a bunch of us kids. I mean, this was 90. I was 24 years old at the time. And,
yeah. You
know, there were guys, you know, younger and older than me, but not by much. And we all lined up and raced. And there was a breakaway that got away kind of early. And, you know, and they were getting some time. And there was no, right, agreement. Like, we were all there. We all paid our own way. We were all kind of riding for ourselves just to see what we could do. And, it was during the race, Andy Hampston came up to me and he's like, hey, you know, KS, Greg's wondering if you guys will ride for him. And we were like, yeah. So here, and this is cool. This is a picture of that, the start line there.
That all those stars
someone
and
gave
stripes
to me. Yeah, yeah. It was
great.
It was
shot.
Pretty cool. Yeah. So all the stars and stripes. So this image here.
Who are those people?
So that's what I was going to point out. So
yeah. This
was all of us that started. So that's going from my left, that's me there. Can you see is my mouse mousing over it or not on your guys' screen?
No, I can't see your mouse.
Okay. So left of the picture would have been the right-hand side of the road. That's myself there.
What bike were you on?
I was on a Landshark, Tongay Prestige. John Slotta made that for me down in Pacoima with lightweight tubing because I had to have a light bike for the world. So that was my special world bike, was a steel bike made out of lighter steel tubing that wasn't as stiff. Me being a sprinter, I liked a stiff bike. Right there, the father of the current yellow jersey wearer, Adrie van der Poel. You know, Stephen, I think it was Stephen Rooks, was it Rooks that was top part of the Worlds in 89. So the Dutch guys lined up. When you lined up by country based on how you placed the last year. So we got to line up at the very front of this race. So this was basically our first European race for so many of us, even though we were in Japan. And we lined up with all these guys that you'd only ever seen in photos. Yeah. But the Americans, the next guy over is Andy Hamm. Then Kenny Adams, kind of dead center, reaching down to the shifter. Michael Carter. Over Carter's left shoulder, and the white headband is James Urbanus next to James. Clark Sheehan.
Clarky
on the, you know, same team there that Carter was on. And then a couple more of the Dutch riders, and then you've got Michael Engelman. Next one over with that kind of reddish headband. And then you can see Bart Bowen in the yellow helmet, the Subaru Montgomery helmet. And just over Bart's right shoulder, I believe that's Gary Mulder. Harry Gary. So that kind of looks like Gary's mullet right there. Yeah. And I don't know where Greg was in this photo. Somebody sent me this. They found it on the AP website. So that was really pretty cool. And then the other one that they found was this one. So this was before the start, right? And there's the AP watermark. There's Greg there. And then there's a young KS sitting in the background. Yeah. And standing up behind me with the glasses and the white polo, that was Mike Neal. Is Mike Neal, who was our director for that. So, yeah, that was really pretty cool.
Those are great shots.
That got to do that, yeah. And then DS can elaborate. We had a trip a few years later.
That
when
was
when Greg had retired. Yeah. And
that was,
it was in Japan as well. So what about that one, Diaz?
Pretty cool trip. We were out at the Interbike Trade Show in 1993. And Greg had definitely, you know, kind of peaked a bit, but he still had a contract with Z. And it's a funny story where we're sitting at the trade show, and I think it was with a day to go, and we see this guy, JP Pascal. He had been the president of Time USA for a while, and then he became Greg's agent. And we see JP, and we're like, hey, JP, what's going on? He goes, oh, man, great, great to see you guys. And he goes, hey. He goes, you guys want to go to Japan? And we're like, what? And he goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, we've got this big race we're doing. It's called the Le Mans Challenge, and which is a great idea. I'm amazed nobody does it. But the premise of Le Mans Challenge was that there was a time trial course supposed to be 10K, and Greg would go out and set a time, and then anybody can show up and plunk their money down and race, you know, against Greg's time, which was a really cool idea. The problem was is that Greg had broken his wrist towards the end of the season, and he wasn't riding anymore. And so basically JP needed a couple of rabbits, you know, to go out ahead and set the time. And so we're like, yeah. Now, it didn't matter that I had kind of finished that year heavily overtrained and I hadn't even touched a bike in 6 weeks, you know, anything like that. And so we go, yeah, it sounds good. When do we leave? And he goes, Monday. And it was Saturday. And we were planning on staying the next day of the show. So we, you know, we turned around and we left the show a day early and drove home and got our tickets and packed up our bikes and went over on that trip.
Yeah. That and it was a trip. There was mountain bikes too.
We ended up, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so was it mountain bikes or mountain bikes and road bikes? I thought there were two that we did both.
Well, there was a road course and a mountain bike course, yeah. But we just brought mountain bikes.
Yeah, and right. Went over and did that.
Yeah, I think initially they just said it was going to be mountain bikes, and then when we got there, they said, oh, there's a road time trial and a mountain bike time trial. And it was like just a couple kilometers, and one it was like a big horseshoe. So yeah. The road thing was just a big horseshoe, maybe a K and a half, 2 Ks. And the mountain bike was the trail within the horseshoe that you kind of went down and back on.
So. I think if we remember correct, it was supposed to be 10K and then there was a big storm.
Yeah, it was pouring.
And the roads got shut down. There was a mudslide across the road. And so the day of the race, we showed up and they're like, hey, the 10K course is shut down. So we put this other course together and it was in a bit of a park, which was supposed to be the start finish area. And you would go ride out and do your loop. Well, the whole thing was in the park. And that was a pretty wild time. I think that we did a road time trial and a mountain bike time trial is what it was, that we did both. And I can remember, you know, we were the last two. The way that they situated is we were the last two to go off. So everybody had done their 2K time trial on the road bike. And then we go out there and I can still remember like trying to find lunch that day. It was the first time I ate barbecued eel, you know, like our, the person from the Japanese Cycling Federation, who had helped us out, Kamiko, I believe was her name. We're like, oh man, we need some lunch. Things are delayed. She goes over, comes back with these like takeout, you know, sushi boxes. And I remember eating barbecued eel. So it's a 2K time trial. And I go out and I make it about, you know, 1K in and my legs just blow up. I hadn't ridden in forever. I got unagi in my stomach and I come around and whoever was the fastest local Japanese guy, I think I didn't beat him by a second, something like that. And the crowd was just like, oh, you know, because they had beat one of the hired guns to come over. But KS was the last guy and he came around and just smoked him. And so then it was like, oh, they were happy, but a little bit bummed. And then I think in the mountain bike time trial, we fared a lot better just because, you know, we had been racing mountain bikes and stuff and they weren't as prepared for it. But one of the funniest stories after that is, so interestingly enough, we got done and, you know, we had jerseys and stuff and Kamiko, the woman from the Japanese Cycling Federation says, hey, we've got a few people who are interested in buying, you know, some of your clothing. Like, do you have any, you know, team jerseys that you want to sell or anything like that? And Kurt and I look at each other and we're like, yeah, you know, end of the season. So we pulled out our gear bags and opened it up. And it was like, just like being in the stock exchange in the old days when they used to write paper tickets. I mean, we were throwing jerseys and they were haggling and, you know, we sold a bunch of jerseys and stuff. But the best part was, you know, Greg couldn't really ride because of his broken wrist, but everybody was just so around. They wanted to see him ride something. So he just happened to hop on my Yeti Ultimate mountain bike and literally like rode it around and that blessed it. And the only like 6'2" Japanese guy I saw there the whole day came up and bought my mountain bike from me because it had been blessed by Greg. So we went home with lighter bags. I was one less bike and wads full of cash. So
yeah, that's right. But
Greg was awesome on that whole trip. He was a character. We were singing karaoke, And if you remember, we were at one point, Greg tried to do the Roger Daltrey with the mic. You know, he used to swing the cord with the mic on it, and the mic detached and went flying through the karaoke bar. We were all up there in our robes. It was a good trip. Yeah, that was for sure.
I wrote an article about that. I'll have to find that for Bicycle Guide, I think, when you were writing there. Yeah, about that whole experience.
Correct.
Yeah, it wasn't really a racing experience. It was a cultural experience. Cultural experience. So,
but that's really great. Just with Greg, just to kind of finish it out for, you know, the ups and downs. I mean, he was a true pioneer, and you know, first and only still winner of the Tour de France for an American, and three times to boot. And so to see him come around and get that, you know, that recognition at this stage in his life is really cool.
So this Congressional Gold Medal, looked it up, is the oldest and highest civilian award in the United States alongside the Presidential Medal of Freedom. It's bestowed by a vote of the United States Congress. So it was like, it wasn't just someone nominated, it had to be voted on. Signed into law by the president. The gold medal expresses the highest national appreciation for distinguished achievements and contributions by individuals or institutions.
Hear, hear.
Here, here. Yeah. So that one for Greg. And if you want to see a little bit more, look up Shane Cooper on the socials. Shane is the founder of Defeat Socks. Him and Paul Willerton, they're close friends with Greg. They were at the event. Shane took a bunch of images and shot video. So he's got some cool stuff there.
That's great. Great.
So where are we going now?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Crusher and the Tusher, Cass.
Yeah. So, you know, there's so much going on with the tour. I brought up the women's Giro Rosa, but one of the original big time gravel events is happening this weekend out in southern Utah, in Beaver, Utah. The Tusher and the Crusher in the Tusher. It's the Tusher Mountain Range. It was established by a guy who raced professional as a road racer in the U.S. for quite a long time, Burke Swindlehurst. Burke started the event in 2011. And he sold it to Lifetime in 22, which was, so 11 years later. It was last year. He was the race director. It became part of the Lifetime Grand Prix event series. It was one of their marquee events in 2023. And again last year in 2024, wildfires, unfortunately, in southern Utah forced the cancellation of the event last year with that. They say it's the hardest 69.9 miles you ever ride. So I guess it's not actually 70 miles. 10,000 feet of vertical in 70 miles. And there's a lot of downhill in that 70 miles. And there's a whole flat section out in this valley. So it's
there's a lot of
what they call the cold, the crush. Climbing. Yeah. Yeah. And I, I got Burke got me into his event. I think it was in 2016 and it crushed me. That's one of the say worst days. Well, it's not worse. One of the most challenging days on the bike I ever had. I underfueled, did not fuel properly, and as I recall, it took me about 2 hours to cover the last 15 miles, which was mostly rolling. And I knew at one point when there was a mom pushing her kid in a baby jogger and they passed me. And I think we were going slightly downhill on a false flat into a headwind. And I was like, so done. But at some point I'd like to go back and see if I could actually, you know, it's about the same amount of climbing as we have here in Nevada County, just a little bit of altitude. So that one, it's a very cool event. I think since it came off of the Lifetime Grand Prix, you know, their quiver of events, they still own it, but it's not part of the Grand Prix. It's gotten a little bit less press. I think part of the reason they took it out is because they had so many events at altitude. They wanted to balance out different types of events for different types of riders and not weight it so heavily to riders that live or train at altitude, you know. And then that leads me, you know, like gravel. Gravel has, you know, Lifetime showed their hand and they started buying a bunch of events, as well as, you know, with Unbound, the biggest gravel event in the world. They started the Big Sugar event out in Bentonville. The Lifetime Grand Prix, they started that, you know. It's like, hey, I mean, changing it up too. They're very innovative.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then we've heard people, you know, it's their selection process isn't fair, this or that. Is it good for gravel? Is it bad for gravel? Is it good or bad for the athletes? You know, it's their event and I think they can do with it whatever they like. There's always going to be haters. For me, the selection process isn't totally transparent, but I've never applied. And I think they're doing what they need to do to create a compelling package for their sponsors. You know, they put on these great events. I've been to the Crusher. I've been to Unbound. I've been to Big Sugar. I have never been to Leadville, another event that they purchased. But I think they're doing a great job of, you know, balancing out for these events. And, you know, ultimately they need to get people to enter these events and they need to get sponsors. So how do you do that? You get innovative with it. You know, for the athletes, it's interesting. This year they did after the first two events, so the Sea Otter Classic, which went from a longer mountain bike event to a gravel event in 2025, and then the Unbound, there was a qualification process for riders that weren't initially selected for the Grand Prix through their criteria. You know, and I can say that, you know, the two winners of the Unbound this year, Cameron Jones from New Zealand, who won the men's event, and Karolina Mignon from Poland, who won the women's event, neither of them were initially selected for the Lifetime Grand Prix. So then you can say, well, does that mean they're not selecting the best riders? Or they've got a selection process that now they're both in the Lifetime Grand Prix and all their points count. So
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I think ultimately it's Lifetime's event and they can do whatever they want to do with it.
Yeah.
They're getting new people in. It reminds me of Iron Man in the 90s. I don't know what you guys think on this.
Well, I'll go ahead, Ed.
I think they're doing a great job. The quick to YouTube videos that they're doing with the helicopter and the, you know, using Starlink from the side by sides and the coverage. And then, you know, their Unbound coverage was, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
I think that their video coverage, their live video coverage and their quick to YouTube, you know, that night or the next night is amazing. I liked seeing the U23 race. We had a local guy qualify here. And it was fun to watch the U23 riders at Sea Otter. It was also really kind of an interesting kick in the pants for me. Mike Hecker was calling the race, a gentleman from Santa Barbara that we all grew up with. And after the race, the U23 riders were all taking family photos with Mike Hecker because, you know, Mike Hecker kind of got them racing their mountain bikes.
Nice.
And so so that was quite a moment to see the U23 riders, you know, the 20 of them that were, you know, Nike riders from Southern California or San Ynez Valley or Santa
right.
Barbara or wherever they were, taking a family photo with Mike Hecker at the center of it. So I like that they're focused on maybe finding the right talent in the U23 process. That's probably a healthy thing. I didn't like when, you know, social media stars were getting selected for the race series.
Right.
That kind of bothered me. But that was sort of more of the initial year when they were just getting started. I'm a big fan. They run a professional operation. I was impressed at Sea Otter.
Yeah, I would say the biggest thing is before Lifetime took it over, I don't remember seeing the helicopter flying around. So, you know, when you talk about pluses and minuses, if somebody big comes in, and I still watch a lot of the World Cup mountain bike and cross country and downhill. And since I used to race World Cup downhill, I find that really interesting. And they've had a lot of changes in the last couple of years since they took it over, that series over from Red Bull and Warner Brothers and who's promoting it. And this year was a big deal in downhill. They had changed it. And, you know, the top 10 on points used to be protected. So you would make it through to the final no matter what. Now there's no protection. They have two qualifying sessions. If you don't make it through in the first one, you got to go back up to the second one. And I think the TV package is a lot better. It looks better. And anytime you're trying to push forward, trying to expand out to a bigger audience, you're going to have to make some changes. And, you know, sometimes the changes are good. Sometimes they look back the next year and say, hey, maybe we could tweak this and tweak that. But I think if somebody's willing to go and invest in a series for the, you know, goal of making it a bigger series and getting on TV better and doing that, then I think more power to them, you know. And in the case of, say, the World Cup, they have something kind of like Lifetime Grand Prix, where if you're not in the group of riders selected to show up and race at a World Cup, it's more limited now. There's regional events that if you win one, you get a one-time pass where you can go and select and race one World Cup downhill. You know, they have qualification procedures. And it kind of reminded me something else we were talking about before we went live is that sometimes that's how it is. You've got to earn your spot. You know, when I grew up racing on the SoCal race circuit and Kurt and I, of course, are sprinters. And so we raced a lot of criteriums. And I could remember my first year in elites showing up to the La Jolla Grand Prix, which was this super fast 7-turn race that it was just strung out from start to finish. And I'm 18 years old and I look up and the front row is all Sevenlin and Schwinn Icy Hot, which were the two best Criterium teams of the day. And I'm thinking to myself, how am I even going to get to the front? I'm already 50 guys back, you know, when they start. But that's the process. You got to earn your way up. And, you know, and I know that every one of those guys that was on 7-Eleven or Schwinn Icy Hot, they didn't just get a contract because they were somebody's friend. They earned their way. They earned their way onto those teams. And so I think that that's great, you know, and if these races, you know, race series have a way that if you're not in that you can earn your way up, then I think it's great. You know, that brings the best riders and the best racing and ultimately the best show.
When you talk about the call-ups for racing, I just get PTSD up my spine thinking about climbing over snow fencing, trying to back my bike in. You know, you guys were a little bit more stars than I was, but like, you know, like climb over the snow fence, put your bike there. Okay, I'm ready to race. And then you look over and the guy, like, he's an 84 Olympian and 84 Olympian.
Right.
You know, and then they're all getting called up. It's climbing over snow fencing to get your start spot is tough stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, that's just what you did though, right? Until you got caught.
My best La Jolla Grand Prix story, one of my best Criterium stories of trying to get a front row start is it was La Jolla Grand Prix 2 years later than that initial year of my elite. So 1989, had some pretty good form that year. And again, you know, all the good teams got called up. I was on a smaller SoCal team, but was racing well. And I'm just like, God, man, how am I going to get to the front? So we're sitting there. I mean, it's just packed, 100 and whatever, 20 guys probably on that course. And all of a sudden we hear this pop, 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 you know, honking, and the pace car, which was like a red convertible, you know, whatever it was, is behind the field and they had to get through to the front, but we're just all packed in there, right? Snow fencing to snow fencing, and it's pop, pop coming through. And so I was like, oh yeah. And that thing moved over. And as soon as it went by, I went right on the bumper, even though it was rolling at like a mile an hour, we were like walking our feet. And I tell you, that was as much of a battle of the back guys of trying to get behind that car, because when it went all the way up to the front, I was third row right behind all the 7-Eleven and Schwinn Icy Hot guys. And yeah, that was one of the first times I think I actually got up to the front and really went for it at La Jolla Grand Prix.
Yeah. Got to get to the shoot. I mean, and I think ultimately, Ed, you touched on it, like the streaming and the post-production, what Lifetime's doing to showcase their events and like the team that they must have behind that, because you pointed out sometimes they're releasing that stuff the night of the event, or you wake up the next morning and it's gone live. Like,
yeah,
they must be editing that stuff as the event's going on. Like, I don't know if they have a production truck right there, but yeah, they've really stepped that up. So it's cool to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had six Starlinks or six cameras. They had an on-site, this is Unbound. They had an on-site studio. They had Payson McKelvin, you know, commentating, and he was excellent, by the way, because, you know, he was out with an injury. That was an excellent job. But, you know, Traca really set the stage for this. They did, you know, E motorcycles, and they were like right in it. Their coverage was amazing. In fact, I really enjoyed their coverage.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Not everybody has the budget of the ASO and the history.
Yeah.
Well, technology works. I mean, look at, we're podcasting and they're live streaming. So.
Yeah. All right. Where are we heading to next?
This is sort of the next section was just kind of any kind of gear, things, rides on your calendar, things that are coming up, you know, products that you're testing, tires that you're using, any kind of interesting industry trends that you guys are seeing out there.
DS, yeah. I know you got some new tires.
I got some new tires. So I'm... You know, I got a new gravel bike in the spring, a Mondraker Arid, and as the size of tires are increasing in gravel, you know, and the frames are accommodating them, I've been running a set of 50 mil Gravel King SKs on there. And, you know, out in Santa Barbara, Carpinteria area where I ride gravel, it's pretty rocky terrain. And so definitely the bigger tires help. And so I'm actually doing some design work for Panaracer on a new gravel tire. And so I've been, as we always do, testing some competitors' tires. And so the, you know, the hottest tires, as Ed, you'll attest to this, are the Continental Race Kings, or now the Dubnatal, which is their new version of it. And then the Schwalbe Thunderbirds for a little bit bigger tires. And so I have a Quality Bike Parts account and had them on order, and they're all sold out. You can't find them anywhere. But I luckily got a set of 2.2 Race Kings, came in, and I ordered those, and I was pretty sure it would fit in the front. I wasn't sure if it was going to fit in the rear, because sometimes it's just hard to tell and how big a tire is, but they fit great in the bike. And man, I went out and rode on those twos, and they are money, you know, just the bigger tires are just nice, more traction in the corners, you know, just better grip, but definitely a smoother ride too, where it's bumpy. And so, yes, of course, if you are out on, you know, just 80% pavement gravel ride, a 2.2 might not be your best tire, but as soon as it gets loose and a little chunky, and I like to hop it around and slide it and stuff, those bigger tires were really nice. So I rode them out on the Carpinteria Bluffs a couple of times and rode them up at Ealing's Park in Santa Barbara, which is another great place for gravel testing. Yeah, size matters. The volume is good. Really good.
So for all the roadies that transition to gravel and they have no idea what a 2.2 is, because that's more of a mountain-like measurement, what's a 2.2 in millimeters?
54 millimeters, I believe, is a 2.2.
54.
Yeah, 2.1 is around.
Depending on the internal width of your rim, but
you know, right.
These have been very popular as of the last year or so. So 54 is a little bit more. Well, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I rode a 2.2 Race King in Belgian Waffle, Arizona. It was great for knocking off any cactus spines and such because it barely fit in my fork. So every time something bad would get on my tire, my fork would take it right off.
But it was a tire cleaner.
Yeah, it was a tire cleaner. I need a little more clearance for that tire, but it was great out there. Unfortunately, I couldn't run that in the back. I was running like a 45 in the back, but it's an excellent tire for out there.
Yeah.
I remember reading your Substack about that ride. You had something else running as well, but we'll save that for another episode.
Tour de Dumoulin, as you called it.
Yeah.
What about you, KS?
Nothing really, man. I mean, my bike, I've been pretty stoked with my bike. It's dialed, you know, both my road and my gravel bikes. I mean, I mentioned on the last episode, I am looking forward to getting a new gravel frame. It looks like, you know, what I'm going to get when I get it is pushed out to sometime in August right now, which is going to be here before I even know it. Will allow me for a little more tire clearance. It is a production frame, a carbon frame. The closest I've ever seen a production frame mimic my custom geometry, what I've come to on my custom tie bike. So I'll be excited to ride that when I do ride it. But mostly I'm just, you know, riding what I got and working on the house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Well, awesome. I think in the coming weeks, we'll record another episode. We're hoping to maybe host a ride on the Carpinteria Bluffs. All three of us ride together and come out and join us after we record in person, hopefully. So we're looking to do that at the end of the month. We appreciate all the nice comments and feedback. Please like, share, pass it on to your friends. We're on YouTube. If you like to watch the video there or stream us on Spotify, where the video is also found. And we appreciate the comments and all the positive mojo, and we'll see you down the road.
Yeah. Thanks everybody for watching and for your comments.
Yeah. Thank you. And as Ed said, please just spread the love. This is in our infancy of doing this, you know, it's got to spread organically. Tell your friends, send them a link, your family, you know, and we'll check out your comments too. Thanks.
All right.
Peace. Thank you.